Progressive Center parties by Blair and Clinton, respectively, in England and in the United States. And we have 40, 45 years of evidence as to what that delivers. And, I mean, just taking in a sort of mass sociological broad stroke view of it, basically everybody in the society scrambles, works harder and harder and harder, even with a flow of cheap commodities produced from around the world, to keep their heads above water. And there's very little social mobility upwards. And all the wealth generated by all the people in society goes to the investor class. That is not a popular vision going forward to maintain that for the American people. And I think at 2016, you saw the dam break on what it was essentially, you know, people thought that there was a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy for decades in the United States. In the rearview mirror, it now looks like there was pretty much a bipartisan consensus on economics. And that broke with the 2016 election. I think Barack Obama's presidency and the singularity of his presidency, first black president, great historical moment, sort of kept American politics, not really electoral politics, responding to the huge crisis of the 2007-2009 market collapse and the Great Recession that followed. And so it was the 2016 election where the dam broke, and you had Bernie Sanders on the left and Donald Trump on the right pulling apart what was a neoliberal consensus. Inside the Democratic Party, in contrast to the Republican Party, the neoliberal center still holds the reins of the party. I think this is against the wishes of the base of the party, but the money power within the Democratic Party holds the Democratic Party as essentially what is a conservative political force. It wants to conserve the status quo ante. Of course.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
A short time ago, the U.S. military carried out massive precision strikes on the three key nuclear facilities in the Iranian regime, Fordo, Natanz, and Esfahan.
The U.S. is calling it Operation Midnight Hammer, joining Israel bombing Iran. The U.S. hitting Iran's nuclear facilities.
I think it is irrelevant to ask Iran to return to diplomacy, because we were in the middle of diplomacy. We were in the middle of talks with the United States when Israelis blew it up.
To get the latest, we'll go to Frankfurt, Chicago, London, and Tehran, which is being bombed as we broadcast. Then Mahmoud Khalil is free. Democracy Now! Was at Newark Airport when he landed.
I just want to go back and just continue the work that I was already doing, advocating for Palestinian rights, a speech that should actually be celebrated rather than punished, as this administration wants to do.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations is warning of a spiral of chaos after the United States joined Israel's war on Iran by attacking three Iranian nuclear sites. U.S. stealth B-2 bombers dropped 14 bunker buster bombs, each weighing 30,000 pounds, the largest non-nuclear bombs ever dropped by the United States. The U.S. Navy also deployed 30 submarine-launched Tomahawk cruise missiles. President Trump ordered the attack without seeking congressional approval. The Trump administration briefed some top Republican lawmakers ahead of time, but no Democrats. Trump addressed the nation Saturday night.
Tonight, I can report to the world that the strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated.
Iran decried the U.S. attack as a grave violation of international law, warning it'll result in everlasting consequences. Iran has long said its nuclear program is solely for civilian purposes. In March, Trump's own intelligence director, Tulsi Gabbard, told lawmakers the intelligence community, quote, continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, unquote. But Trump dismissed the findings, saying Friday, quote, my intelligence community is wrong. On Sunday, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi criticized the timing of the U.S. and Israeli attacks.
Well, I think it is irrelevant to ask Iran to return to diplomacy because we were in the middle of diplomacy. We were in the middle of talks with the United States when Israelis blew it up.
Araghchi is in Moscow today for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Following the U.S. attack, Pentagon officials and Vice President J.D. Vance denied the U.S. is pushing for regime change. But on Sunday, President Trump wrote online, quote, it's not politically correct to use the term regime change, but if the current Iranian regime is unable to, MEGA, make Iran great again, why wouldn't there be a regime change? MEGA, M-I-G-A. At the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he was gravely alarmed by the U.S. attack.
2 days ago, in this very chamber, I made a direct appeal. Give peace a chance. That call was not heeded. Instead, the bombing of Iranian nuclear facilities by the United States marks a perilous turn in a region that is already reeling. From the outset of the crisis, I have repeatedly condemned any military escalation in the Middle East. The people of the region cannot endure another cycle of destruction.
Earlier today, Israel attacked 6 Iranian airports and parts of Tehran, including the gates of the Evin prison. Al Jazeera reports huge explosions have rocked Tehran. According to one count, Israeli attacks have killed at least 950 people and injured around 3,450 over the past 11 days. Iran launched drones and fired missiles at Israel today in response. One missile struck a power station, cutting off electricity for thousands in southern Israel. On Sunday, the Iranian parliament voted to back the closing of the Strait of Hormuz, one of the world's most important shipping routes. We'll have more on Iran after headlines. Protests took place in major U.S. cities to condemn Trump's strikes on Iran, including in New York, D.C., Boston, Chicago, and Los Angeles. This is activist Nasisa speaking from New York Sunday.
Already, Israel has killed hundreds of Iranians and injured thousands more, and we see that the fighting is now escalating more and more. We're here to say that's enough, and it's time for the bombing to end.
Columbia University graduate, Palestinian student protest leader Mahmoud Khalil is free. He's been reunited with his wife and newborn son after being released on bail by a federal judge Friday following over 100 days in the Louisiana ICE jail. He was seized by federal agents in March, becoming the first pro-Palestinian campus protester to be jailed by the Trump administration. Mahmoud Khalil spoke briefly Saturday after flying from Louisiana to Newark Airport.
Still, the fight is far from over. The genocide is still happening in Gaza. Israel is still waging a full war against Palestinians across Palestine. The U.S. government is funding this genocide, and Columbia University is investing in this genocide. This is why I was protesting. This is why I will continue to protest with every one of you. Not only if they threaten me with detention, even if they would kill me, I would still speak up for Palestine.
On Sunday, Mahmoud Khalil addressed over 1,000 supporters and the press outside the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in Manhattan, then led a march to the gates of Columbia University. We'll have more from Mahmoud Khalil later in the broadcast. While the world is focused on Iran, Israel's continuing its massacres in Gaza. Israeli attacks killed over 200 Palestinians over the past 3 days, including many who were killed while waiting to receive food and humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, Amnesty International reports satellite images show Israeli forces have completely razed what was left of the southern Gaza town of Gazaa. Amnesty said the destruction, quote, provides fresh evidence of Israel's genocide against Palestinians in the occupied Gaza Strip, unquote. In the United Kingdom, the group Palestine Action's leading a major protest in London today amidst reports the Labour government of Keir Starmer will announce a ban on the direct action group under Britain's Terrorism Act. This comes after two Palestine Action activists breached the country's largest Air Force base Friday and damaged two fighter planes in protest of Britain's support for Israel's war on Gaza. The activists also sprayed red paint into the jet's engines and on the runway to, quote, symbolize Palestinian bloodshed, unquote. In Syria, a suicide bomb attack at a Greek Orthodox church in Damascus killed at least 22 people Sunday. Over 60 others were wounded. Syria's interior ministry blamed the attack on ISIS. It was reportedly the first suicide bombing in Damascus since Bashar al-Assad's government was toppled in December. In California, there's mounting public outrage after footage went viral of at least seven masked U.S. Border Patrol agents pepper spraying and brutally beating an immigrant father and landscaper while he worked outside of an IHOP restaurant in Santa Ana. Narciso Barranco is the father of three U.S. Marines. The agents are seen hovering over Barranco, who is pinned down against the pavement as they repeatedly punch him before forcibly putting him in the back seat of an unmarked SUV. The 48-year-old father was taken to a detention facility in Los Angeles after his arrest Saturday. One of his sons told the Los Angeles Times that his father's shoulder was dislocated, that he had not received medical attention. Barranco's son also said his father had not been given any water or food after more than 24 hours in detention. In related news, rallies have continued demanding the release of photojournalist Anthony Orendorff, who is being held at a Los Angeles jail without bail after being arrested while documenting an ICE raid in the neighborhood of Pacoima last week. In more immigration news, a federal judge in Tennessee has ordered the release of Maryland father Kilmar Abrego Garcia from jail, where he's been held since being brought back to the United States earlier this month after being wrongfully sent to and imprisoned in El Salvador. But Abrego Garcia will likely be then taken into ICE custody while he awaits his federal trial. The Trump administration's accusing him of helping transport undocumented immigrants charges his legal team and family have denied. Kilmar Abrego Garcia pleaded not guilty to trafficking earlier this month. In Ukraine, a major Russian drone and missile attack has killed at least 10 people in and around the capital, Kyiv. It's the second such overnight assault over the past week. The attack hit residential areas and struck a hospital and metro station that serves as a bomb shelter. The government of Belarus has freed the jailed opposition leader Sergei Tikhanovsky, alongside over a dozen other political prisoners after direct talks with the U.S. He was imprisoned in 2020 ahead of national elections in which he planned to challenge the longtime rule of the Belarusian president Alexander Lukashenko. Sergei's wife, Svetlana, ran for president instead, but lost in what was widely viewed as a rigged election. On Saturday, Sergei Tikhanovsky was reunited with his family, who live in exile in Lithuania. He told reporters his children did not even recognize him. He also addressed his supporters.
They call those who oppose them traitors, and I will call anyone who does not resist them a traitor. I want to address all Belarusians now and tell you, if you were waiting for a sign, here it is.
The government of Panama has declared a state of emergency, suspending constitutional protections in the Bocas del Toro province after 2 months of worker-led protests and road blockades in opposition to a contested social security reform. The province is a major banana-producing region where workers have spoken out against exploitative conditions by banana giant Chiquita. The corporation, formerly known as United Fruit Company, fired thousands of striking workers last month. And Texas has become the largest state in the country to require the Ten Commandments be displayed in all public school classrooms. Texas's Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed the bill as a federal appeals court ruled a similar law in Louisiana is, quote, plainly unconstitutional. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States has joined Israel's war on Iran by attacking three Iranian nuclear sites over the weekend. U.S. B-2 bombers dropped 14 bunker buster bombs on Iranian nuclear facilities in Fordo and Natanz. Each bomb weighs 30,000 pounds. They're the largest non-nuclear bombs in the U.S. arsenal. The U.S. Navy also launched 30 Tomahawk cruise missiles from a submarine at the nuclear site in Isfahan. President Trump ordered the attack without seeking congressional approval. He addressed the nation Saturday night.
Tonight, I can report to the world that the strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated.
Speaking at a news conference in Istanbul following the U.S. strikes, the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, said the United States would be, quote, solely and fully responsible, unquote, for the consequences.
Islamic Republic of Iran condemns in the strongest terms the United States' brutal military aggression against Iran's peaceful nuclear facilities. It is an outrageous, grave, an unprecedented violation of the fundamental principles of the Charter of the United Nations and international law. The warmongering and lawless administration in Washington is solely and fully responsible for the dangerous consequences and far-reaching implications of its act of aggression.
Following the U.S. bombardment, Israel's carried out new waves of strikes against dozens of targets across Iran, many considered symbols of the Iranian regime. This includes bombing the gates of the notorious Evin prison, where political prisoners, regime opponents, and foreign nationals are held. While U.S. officials in the Pentagon and Vice President J.D. Vance have said the U.S. role will not be to pursue regime change in Iran, President Trump's position is less clear. On Sunday, President Trump wrote online, "It's not politically correct to use the term regime change, but if the current Iranian regime is unable to make Iran great again, why wouldn't there be a regime change? MEGA," he said, "make Iran great again." For more, we're joined by guests in Brussels, in London, in Chicago, but we begin in Tehran with Mohammad Mirandi, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran, part of the nuclear deal negotiations in 2015. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain what's happening on the ground as we speak, and specifically over the weekend, the U.S. Joining Israel in bombing Iran?
People across the country are outraged, and contrary to what the regime in Washington and the regime in Tel Aviv seem to expect, people are rallying around the flag, and they are all saying that this was an unprovoked act of war that the Israeli regime carried out with U.S. support as Iran was negotiating. And then days later, in support of the Israeli regime, the United States carried out its own act of war as the Iranians were continuing to negotiate, and right after negotiations with Britain, France, and Germany. So Iranians see the United States as the aggressor, as helping the Israeli regime slaughter Iranians. Most Iranians who've died so far are civilians. And today we've seen the regime strike targets in the Iranian capital, civilian targets, killing more people. We've had funerals across the country, 2 7-year-old children in Tabriz, a city in northwestern Iran, where they had a funeral procession today. So there's anger across the board, and this is going to have huge implications for the future. A generation of young Iranians who many thought that there could somehow be a deal and rapprochement with the United States are seeing the different face of Washington and how Democrats and Republicans demonize Iran alongside one another. People in Iran have been passing around images and footage of CNN demonizing Iran, speaking about sleeper cells in the United States, showing that CNN and Fox News are not different at all. They demonize the country. They use the term regime to delegitimize and justify aggression against the country. And they try to create a false image of the country in order to prepare the grounds for further aggression. These are things that people are seeing, especially the young and educated Iranians who have greater access to international media.
Professor Mirandi, there are many Iranian dissidents, but thousands of people have taken to the streets to protest the U.S. bombing and the Israeli bombing of Iran. Now Israel's bombed the gates of the notorious Evin prison, where political prisoners are held. Can you talk about the significance of this and if this has shifted Iranians' views at all at this point? And also, President Trump doing a 180-degree turn, J.D. Vance saying this is not about regime change, we're not against Iran, we're against their nuclear program, and then President Trump saying, no, it's about regime change, MEGA, make Iran great again. Talk about the significance of the prison and what this means. Could it divide Iranians?
No, because Iranians don't see the government and the state in a way in which American media and American establishment, the American establishment sees it. Iran sees the Islamic, Iranians overwhelmingly see the Islamic Republic of Iran as a legitimate state. And now after the aggression, that has increased. Evin prison, the majority of the people there are there because of drug trade. They're linked to the drug trade, and usually they are major figures in the drug trade. You know that in Afghanistan, thanks to the U.S. occupation and the destruction of that country, thanks to the United States over four decades, we have a huge drug problem in Afghanistan, and therefore a lot of the major figures are in that particular prison. Also, we have ISIS members and Al-Qaeda members in that prison. And ISIS and Al-Qaeda have been helping the Israeli regime carry out drone strikes inside Iran. So I think that is a misreading of the situation in Iran. Ordinary Iranians are looking at the United States as the aggressor. And overwhelmingly, Iranians demand that the government, the armed forces, protect the country and punish the aggressor.
I want to bring into this conversation with you, Mohammad Mirandi, Syed Hussein Mousavian. He is a visiting research collaborator with Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security. From 2003 to 2005, he served as spokesperson for Iran in its nuclear negotiations with the European Union, author of The Iranian Nuclear Crisis, a memoir, and most recently, Iran and the United States, an insider's view on the failed past and the road to peace. His new op-ed for Middle East Eye, headlined After U.S. Attack, Iran could reconsider its nuclear strategy. Thanks so much for joining us from Brussels, Ambassador Hussein Mousavian. If you can respond to what the U.S. has done, it's interesting to have both of you on because Mohammad Mirandi was involved with the Iran deal negotiations in 2015 and you back a decade before.
It is obvious, Amy, that the U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran is in a clear violation of international law and regulations. It is a clear violation of United Nations security, United Nations Charter. It is in a clear violation of the International Atomic Energy Agency rules and regulations. And many experts now are talking that the current attacks are not only attacks on Iran, they are attacks on non-proliferation treaty. It is it would have definitely a counterproductive result. I mean, the fact is, Amy, that Israel is the only country in the region with 100 to 400 nuclear bombs, and Iran is member of NPT. Israel is not. Iran does not have nuclear bomb. Israel does have nuclear bomb. And Iran has given the highest, the most inspections to the IAEA during the history of IAEA, and Israel has never given such access to IAEA. And now Iran is the most sanctioned country, and the U.S. is supporting Israel with nuclear bombs, and they both are claiming that they are fighting proliferation in the Middle East. I mean, practically, the U.S. is supporting a country with nuclear bomb, attacking a country with no nuclear bomb, claiming that the U.S. is fighting for proliferation in the Middle East. Therefore, Iranians are now looking for TS being member of the non-proliferation treaty, giving every access to the IAEA. And now they have been attacked before they have been sanctioned. And countries like North Korea, Israel, India, Pakistan, which they have never accepted non-proliferation treaty, they have never been attacked. That's why they are now thinking perhaps having nuclear bomb is much better deterrence compared to being member of NPT.
I mean, this is an extremely important point you're making, Ambassador. The issue of whether this would encourage nuclear proliferation, that you have Iran, a non-nuclear nation at this point, being attacked by two nuclear nations, the U.S. and Israel. So the lesson learned is you need to be a nuclear bomb-armed nation not to be attacked. For example, the U.S. isn't attacking North Korea. So if you can talk about what this means and the idea that you can come up with a military solution to what's happening in Iran. It now may be well that the nuclear material has been moved from the place that the U.S. bombed, from Fordo. And so in the end, it's going to take diplomacy anyway.
First of all, from the day one when Israelis, they attacked Iran, I publicly said this is not Israeli strike. Israel has coordinated this military invasion of Iran by the NATO countries, by the U.S., and it is fully supported by NATO, and Iran is confronting NATO, not only Israel. And it is now about 12 days past. Everybody now understands that the NATO countries, they are fully supporting Israel, and the U.S. also attacked Iran by the demand of Israelis. This is number one. Number two, if President Trump really wanted a nuclear deal, he could get it easily, because in his first term, he killed the JCPOA, Amy, you remember. JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, was agreed between Iran and the U.S. and the world powers. The United Nations Security Council passed the resolution 2231. The IAEA adopted many resolutions. It was working very well. Iran gave the highest level of access, inspection, transparency measures to the IAEA. Every technical issues with the IAEA was resolved. Even IAEA publicly said all possible military dimension issues are resolved. The deal was working very well. Even beyond the nuclear, Iran and the U.S., they agreed that Iran would buy 100 American passenger planes, the Boeing planes. Even when 16 American sailors, they entered Iranian water territory illegally, Iran released them in less than 48 hours. I mean, everything was going in the right direction until President Trump withdrew and imposed the most comprehensive sanctions. This is about the first term of President Trump. In the second term, when he was elected, he actually put an option on the Iranian table, deal under my terms and conditions or you would be attacked. This was not and is not the language of diplomacy. This is the language of threat and bullying. And then we had Iranian Foreign Minister with Araghchi, Iranian Foreign Minister Araghchi with Steve Witkoff. They had three rounds of talks in Oman and Rome, and they agreed on the principles. I mean, they really agreed. Then they agreed that the technical team would see it and they would draft it to be signed. Suddenly, Prime Minister Netanyahu called President Trump and President Trump backed down. And then Israel attacked Iran. When Israel attacked Iran, then President Trump publicly said to Iranians, unconditional surrender. And then the U.S. attacked. And now after the U.S. attack, now it's saying regime change. Therefore, now everybody, I think, has a correct understanding, well understanding that unfortunately, President Trump is not really for diplomacy and the solution. Otherwise, if really they want a solution on the nuclear, it is easy because we have three major issues. One is about Iran cooperation with the IAEA. We have the model. The model worked for 3 years very well. Every technical issues were resolved. The nuclear deal, they can agree that all transparency measures, verification measures can be revived based on the deal and every technical issues can be resolved between Iran and the IAEA. The second issue is about whether Iranian enrichment would be military or civilian. If it is below 5%, definitely would be civilian. Iran is ready to go back to, like the JCPOA, to go back to enrichment below 5%, to a stop 20%, to a stop 60%. And the third issue is about the Iranian stockpile of enriched 400 kilogram of 60% enriched uranium. I think if there is a comprehensive, fair, and balanced deal, Iran would be ready either to export or to dilute this stockpile. Therefore, every concern would be removed. It is really within the reach if President Trump is going to have diplomacy succeed.
We've just spoken with Ambassador Mohammad Mirandi in Brussels, who helped to negotiate an Iran nuclear deal back in 2005. Mohammad Mirandi, who is a professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran, part of the nuclear deal negotiations in 2015. And we just heard from Ambassador Hossein Mousavian, who was involved in negotiations in 2005. I want to bring in a third Iranian, an Iranian-American, a voice from civil society here in the U.S., and the call to stop the war on Iran. That's the name of a petition that's gathered more than 1,000 signatures by academics based in the U.S., Europe, and Iran. It reads in part, quote, Netanyahu and Trump are dragging the U.S. into Israel's illegal war in Iran, which will cause more destruction and further destabilize the Middle East for the foreseeable future, unquote. The petition also notes, quote, this aggression is also a calculated attempt to deflect attention from the ongoing genocide it's committing in Gaza and to unleash a cascade of catastrophes that aim to turn Iran into a failed state, unquote. The petition continuing, the Middle East is replete with tragic cases of societies descending into chaos following foreign interventions. Libya, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan. For more, we're joined by one of the petition's organizers, the Iranian-American professor Kaveh Ehsani, associate professor of international studies at DePaul University in Chicago, also contributing editor at Merit and on the board of its directors, in regular communication with activists, journalists, and scholars in Iran. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Ehsani. Explain this 1,000-person signed petition and why you're acting now.
Glad to be here. Thank you. The point is that I agree with most of what was said in terms of, you know, the international situation. The key point is that there's a tendency to speak in the name of Iranians in general, you know, represent them as if though they want this regime, they don't want the regime, they want forceful external military intervention to replace the regime or not. Our point was, as scholars of Iran, as people who've been studying it, who've worked there, who've done field work, who've lived and worked in Iran, is that nobody can at this point speak for Iranians as a whole. Your first speaker, Mr. Marandi, pointed out that there's a universal consensus among Iranians to support the establishment, the Islamic Republic, that Evin prison is, you know, in fact full of petty criminals. Nothing is further from the truth, and this is, you know, laughable as a claim. It is full of political prisoners, many of them waiting execution for protesting the regime. But the point is that Iranians can speak, and as a diverse society of 90 million, they have multiple views. Some indeed support the current establishment, many do not. But the point is that there is a consensus against this war of aggression from outside because it's affecting everyone. And Iran is a society that has lived already through one devastating war, the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. There is solidarity, there is horizontal mutual help, but the fact is that sanctions and war only immiserate people, only destroy civil society and the existing organizations that people have built as ways of pushing back against repressions, against authoritarianism. So what we see, what we support effectively here in our statement is that we should really put our belief and support behind civil society organizations in Iran, trade unions, nurses, pensioners, feminists working in Balochistan, in you know, and other active civil society organizations that are first opposing the war, as fully realizing that what this is doing is immiserating further the lives of ordinary people, people making it harder to actually organize, to actually voice their opinions, to voice their positions. And secondly, it will only open the hands of the regime to accuse anybody who is objecting to the current situation as a fifth columnist, as they are doing. For example, the current Iranian regime has targeted Afghan refugees, the most vulnerable strata of Iranian society, as a potential fifth column. And they're expelling them even more forcefully than they were before. If you think ICE is doing worse, you know, awful things in the United States, the Iranian regime is doing the same thing with Afghan refugees at this point. So the only chance that we have of actually establishing a democratic polity in Iran, whether this leads to the regime change, whether it leads to its transformation from within, you know, through reform, through negotiation, or, you know, through more radical means, that's up to Iranian people inside. External military interventions will only destroy the possibility of democracy. And I think
we have 20 seconds.
You know, but this was the gist of our statement, and we really stand with civil society organizations in Iran, and I think we should condemn this war no matter what, but this is not in support of the existing Islamic Republic.
Kaveh Ehsani, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of International Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. He helped organize the Stop the War on Iran petition that has already more than 1,000 signatures. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll speak with a former Israeli peace negotiator. Stay with us. Then Mahmoud Khalil, in his own words, free. Stay with us.
To the misanthropic, misbegotten merchants of gloom, who look into their crystal balls and prophesy our doom, let the death knell chime, it's the end of time. Let the cynics put their blinkers on and toast our decline. Don't become demoralized by
There's going to be a better day by Billy Bragg performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, following the U.S. strikes on the Iranian nuclear facilities, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke in glowing terms about President Trump and said all their goals will be achieved.
Regarding Fordo, I believe we must take our hats off to our great friend, my close friend, President Trump, for the excellent work done by the U.S. military and the U.S. Air Force. We commend their achievement. They caused a very serious blow there, a very significant one. We will, of course, assess everything. In any case, we will ensure there is no threat from these nuclear facilities. We will do whatever is necessary to achieve the goals we set. And we will achieve them all.
For more, we're joined in London by Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. Thank you, Daniel, for being with us. We only have a few minutes, but if you can respond as Netanyahu praised President Trump for being strong, and President Trump, up until this point, first said this isn't about regime change, and very clearly said it is about regime change. Your response?
Netanyahu's purpose was to drag Trump in. That was the singular goal, really, to make this America's war. Israel doesn't care. In fact, it prefers America to be less popular, more hated in the region, because Israel's project is to be a regional hegemon that can only happen with America in order not so much to do what it's doing to Iran, but in order to continue to pursue the ethnic cleansing, dispossession, displacement, apartheid and genocide against the Palestinian people. That is not a project that has a soft power component. It only has hard power. It's like Elizabeth Warren said, I have a plan for that when confronted with everything. Israel acts like it has a bomb for that, whatever the question is. And so the danger now is that having brought the US into this, Israel will seek to go further up the escalatory ladder, go up the ladder of its objectives, and really bring the idea of regime change, which I don't think even it believes in, some kind of neat change. It wants the chaos, it wants the failed state. In a country of 90 million, that's a threat to the region and beyond. It hopes it can drag the Americans further in, it can get them on this regime change track. And at the moment, Israel looks at it and it sees President Trump wearing a Made in Israel gimp suit. So why not carry on up that ladder? And it also looks at this, and Netanyahu here is taking something of a risk because he's already got something of a win. But I think he looks at it and says, this is the moment. I had the previous administration, President Biden, do something which was optimistic, even by the standards of the peculiarity and exceptionality of the Israel-US relationship. I had a Democrat president support my genocidal war. Now I have a Republican president ready to be part of my war against Iran. And what we're seeing from the Democrats, I think we have to acknowledge, is they seem to be owning the mantle of the thinking person's war party, which is just so short of what is needed. The comments from them have been so little, so late. But this is a very dangerous escalation to be on. We've already heard your guest speaking about the dangers of proliferation well beyond this. We see how dangerous it is in the region. And the rest of the world is looking at this and saying, what lessons do we learn? That America uses negotiations as a ruse, that America is pulled into a war by an ally. And people probably didn't hear, but I'm going to tell you what the Chinese representative said at the UN, because this is how America looks in the world now, and this is how China is positioning itself. China stood up as the leader of multilateralism, diplomacy, and international law at the Security Council, and America violated all of those things.
Daniel Levy, I want to thank you for being with us, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator under two Israeli prime ministers, speaking to us from London. Coming up next, Mahmoud Khalil is free. Stay with us.
No.
Norwegian singer Emil Mefluthi performing at the People's Graduation for Mahmoud Khalil last month. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Columbia University graduate, Palestinian student protest leader Mahmoud Khalil has been reunited with his wife and newborn son after being released on bail by a federal judge Friday after spending over 100 days in an ICE jail. He was seized by federal agents March 8th. His wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, a U.S. citizen, was 8 months pregnant at the time. Mahmoud spoke briefly Saturday after flying from Louisiana to Newark Airport, joined by Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Democracy Now! Was at Newark Airport. We're at Newark Airport, and we're waiting for Mahmoud Khalil to come out. He has just landed. His plane was diverted to Philadelphia, then took off again. Is at Newark. Right now, he's playing with his baby Dean. He's reunited with his family, and he's about to walk into the press scrum. And there are a number of people here who are here to greet him, playing drums. They have flowers for him. He's coming out.
Friends, thank you so much for everything.
Not only
for today. It's just for every day. Like, just your words of support, your messages have kept me going. Still, the fight is far from over. The genocide is still happening in Gaza. Israel is still waging a full war against Palestinians across Palestine. The U.S. government is funding this genocide, and Columbia University is investing in this genocide. This is why I was protesting. This is why I will continue to protest with every one of you, not only if they threaten me with detention, even if they would kill me, I would still speak up for Palestine. Again, I just want to go back and just continue the work that I was already doing, advocating for Palestinian rights, a speech that should actually be celebrated rather than punished, as this administration wants to do. But we'll take a few questions.
Mahmoud, what would you say to the Trump administration, because they wanted to keep you detained? What is your message for President Trump?
Just the fact that I am here, it's a message. The fact that all these attempts to suppress pro-Palestine voices have failed now. So this is the message. My existence is a message. The Palestinian existence is a message to this administration.
Mahmoud, how does it feel to be free? How does it feel to be free?
To be honest, I'm still trying to just comprehend that. Of course, it feels great. When I was on the inside, I was free. It's just I was locked up. The fact that they put me in that place, that didn't mean that I was not free. I continued to advocate for Palestinians, for the immigrants who are left behind in that facility, that 1,200 men who, all of them, are incredible men, who the Trump administration are trying to portray as whether criminals or just like illegals, as they say. And as I said yesterday, whether you are a citizen, an immigrant, anyone on this land, you're not illegal. That doesn't make you less of a human. And this is what the administration is trying to do, to dehumanize me, to dehumanize the immigrants, to dehumanize anyone who actually does not agree with what the administration is doing.
Thank you, everyone. First of all, first and foremost, I think we speak on behalf of so many people across this country, across the state of New York, but also across so many communities in the United States in welcoming Mahmoud home, to be here and to be reunited with his wife and his newborn son. Mahmoud Khalil was imprisoned for 104 days by this administration, by the Trump administration, with no grounds and for political reasons. Because Mahmoud Khalil is an advocate for Palestinian human rights, he has been accused baselessly of horrific allegations simply because the Trump administration and our overall establishment disagrees with his political speech. This was a form, his detention by ICE, being taken from his home, as well as other advocates, Ms. Ozturk in Boston, Massachusetts, ripped off of the street, being taken is wrong, it is illegal, it is a violation of his First Amendment rights, it is an affront to every American, and we will not allow and we will continue to resist the politicization and the continued political persecution that ICE is engaged in.
I'm Bahar Azmi, AZMY, for the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of his attorneys. This is an incredibly significant and important victory, although one that came far too late. And as much as we're celebrating, I think we can't fully let go of the outrage that Mahmoud had to fight for so long and so hard against this outrageous and unconstitutional government conduct by the administration, namely to persecute him simply for advocacy for Palestine and dissenting from United States foreign policy. I think Mahmoud and Palestinian advocates are still the tip of the authoritarian spear with this administration. But collectively, I think people want to keep up the resistance and keep up the fight for justice in Palestine.
Ramzi Qasim, Clear Project, CUNY School of Law, we're attorneys for Mr. Khalil.
Can you first respond to Mahmoud's being freed? Tell us what took so long. What was the decision that the judge made? What was it based on after these months?
The district judge, quite appropriately, yesterday, took a hard and studied look at all of the factors that govern release and found that there was absolutely no basis, none. He was unequivocal. Mahmoud is not a danger of any sort. He's not a flight risk of any kind. And there's absolutely no justification for his detention. The judge did this meticulously, methodically, in a two-hour hearing that should withstand any sort of appellate scrutiny. The fundamental reality remains that Mahmoud Khalil was detained by this administration in an attempt to make an example out of him, in an attempt to stifle speech that frankly should be celebrated and commended, speech in defense of the human rights of Palestinians, their dignity, their right to life, speech in opposition to an ongoing genocide. And for that, the administration tried to make an example out of him and tried to establish a template that it would then apply to any other set of issues that it happens to disagree with. That, as we've seen today, is failing. It is backfiring. Mahmoud is out, of course, and he is, as you heard, uncowed, unbowed. He's going to resume his activism. But he's not alone, more importantly. Hundreds of thousands of others have expressed not just their solidarity with him, but their solidarity with the Palestinian people. And this is not a movement that the Trump administration is going to be able to deport its way out of. It is very much an American movement.
Does Mahmoud face deportation today? Explain the difference between the two courts.
Well, the simplest way to think about it is that the immigration case is the Trump administration's case. It's the case that they want because it's before an immigration judge who isn't really a judge at all. An immigration judge is a DOJ employee, Department of Justice employee, who serves at the pleasure of the president and can be fired by the president at any time. The case in federal court in New Jersey, on the other hand, now that's Mahmoud's case. That's the case that he brought to vindicate his own constitutional rights in front of an independent judge who does not serve at the pleasure of the president, who has lifetime tenure, and who, as was demonstrated yesterday, can issue rulings that are critical of the president. The contrast was extremely clear yesterday. You had a federal judge agreeing with Mahmoud and vindicating his constitutional rights against the Trump administration. And at the same time, you had an immigration judge who's an employee of the Trump administration agreeing with the Trump administration. There could be no clearer illustration of the difference between the administrative immigration proceedings and Mahmoud's constitutional case in federal court.
So does he face deportation?
He is in ongoing removal proceedings. We will continue to fight that fight, and that's why the fight is not over. But the latest round of this fight was resoundingly won by Mahmoud Khalil.
Ramzi, you were there when Mahmoud was freed. Can you describe what that was like? And also, making your way from Jena, Louisiana, you flew from Dallas to Newark.
Amy, I was there with Mahmoud. We were listening to the hearing in court together in Jena, in a room over a phone. And, when the ruling came down...
From the bench at that moment?
Yeah. When the ruling came down over that phone, he and I jumped up. We hugged each other. We screamed. We shouted. And then we started planning. And, we drove through the night to catch the first flight out. We haven't slept, but we're happy, and I can't imagine his happiness at embracing his wife and child and their happiness. And I'm just ecstatic that they're together, that they get this time to be together. They should have never been separated, of course, but now they are together, and he is in a much better position, not just to fight these legal cases that we've been talking about, but also to resume his all important political work as an outspoken advocate for the most basic human rights for the Palestinian people.
We are standing at Newark Airport, where Mahmoud Khalil has just arrived, reuniting with his wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, and his almost two-month-old son, Dean, whose birth he missed as he was jailed for more than 100 days in Jena, Louisiana. And as we stand here at Newark Airport, we're in Terminal A, where he came out and welcomed his supporters and talked to the press. We're standing in front of a mural by the Ecuadorian muralist Leica Nuna Yawar. It is a mural that celebrates immigrants in the United States. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
So that was Saturday. On Sunday, Mahmoud Khalil addressed over 1,000 supporters as well as the press outside the Cathedral of St. John the Divine here in Manhattan, blocks from the campus of Columbia University.
I would like to salute the courage of all students at Columbia and across the nation. These students who continue to protest, I want to honor especially my friends at Columbia University. Especially those who are currently battling expulsion and suspension for their consciousness stand. As many of you know, the Board of Trustees at Columbia, the shameful Board of Trustees at Columbia, is currently attempting to expel 15 more students and to suspend 10 of others, basically stealing their future, their degrees, their labor, merely because these students are not afraid. These students are not afraid to stand for Palestine. Columbia University will do everything and anything it can to ensure that the words "Free Palestine" are not uttered anywhere near it. But while we are here, free Palestine! Palestine.
Free Palestine!
Viva Palestina!
Viva Palestina!
Viva Palestina! I hope that Columbia University heard your chants. In fact, Even today, Columbia University refused to allow this press conference and rally to be held at the gates. Just so that we cannot remind them that they fund the killing in Gaza. Well, who is Mahmoud Khalil? That's what the administration has tried its best to portray me as, someone who's violent. Mahmoud Khalil is a human rights defender. Mahmoud Khalil is a freedom fighter. Mahmoud Khalil is a refugee. Mahmoud Khalil is a father and husband. And above all, Mahmoud Khalil is Palestinian. Mahmoud Khalil is a Palestinian who refused to remain silent while watching a genocide in Palestine. A genocide that's, of course, committed by the genocidal state of Israel, that's funded by the U.S. government, that's invested by Columbia University.
Mahmoud Khalil, addressing over 1,000 supporters as well as the press outside the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in Manhattan. He then led a march as the marchers held the banner, "Welcome Home, Mahmoud." He wore a Palestinian flag as a cape, and they marched from 110th Street, where the cathedral is, to Columbia University at 116th Street. Mahmoud Khalil still faces deportation, but now can deal with these proceedings as a free man, with his wife, Dr. Noor Abdallah, and his newborn son, Dean Khalil. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Laura Bastios. To see our job openings, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
You took the first step and quit smoking, but even former smokers may still be at risk for lung cancer.